This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series.
Hello, my name is Nicholas Morgan, and this is Turkey Abroad. I'd like to welcome back to the program Blaise Miştal. He is the Vice President for Policy at the Jewish Institute for National Security of America in Washington, D.C. Blaise, pleasure to have you back.
Nicholas, thanks for having me. Always good to speak with you.
So there's a lot going on now since we last spoke. Joe Biden's now president. His administration's getting comfortable in office, and they've had their first interactions with Turkey through some recent statements in the last month. And on that front, you predicted last time that you expected some rhetorical changes in how Biden would engage with Turkey, and that's primarily what we got so far. State Department released statements related to the treatment of students at Boğaziçi University, anti-LGBTQ rhetoric during those arrests, and it also went ahead and called for the release of Osman Kavala and Selahattin Demirtaş. It is, of course, way too soon, probably, to really judge how Biden's overall policy towards Turkey will shape up compared to his predecessors. But what kind of tone do you think that the Biden administration may be trying to support right now towards Turkey, in your view?
Well, before I say anything about the tone, I'd say that if I were a Biden official that was working on Turkey, I think I would have whiplash in just the 4 weeks that I've been in office. I mean, we've gone from offers of resetting relations to accusations of masterminding the coup to renewed offers of deep strategic partnership to renewed accusations of, you know, supporting the PKK to extended hands once again. I mean, it's really been hard to keep up with what exactly Turkey's stance on the United States is. And I think that's probably causing some head scratching in the corridors of power here in Washington. But despite that, I think we have seen a consistency in the positions of this administration that are consonant with what the previous administration said as well, which is on the major issues, the S-400 remains a problem and will remain a problem until Turkey is no longer in possession of the S-400. That has been stated clearly now by the State Department and the Defense Department that Turkey is not going to be part of the F-35 program so long as the S-400 is around. And then we've seen sort of an addition to the list of issues that the United States brings up, which is the question of human rights and the detention of people that seem to be being held unjustly, which has always been perhaps in the background, certainly did not figure so much during the Trump administration, but now has certainly taken a front row seat for this administration. As we've heard President Biden talk about him trying to bring democracy and values back to his approach to foreign policy, we're certainly seeing that in his approach to Turkey and other regional countries. But it also is a renewed concern for Congress. We saw a letter from 54 senators to the president saying that they really want Turkey to be held accountable for its backsliding on democracy. So I think there is a firm, constant message that we've heard there. But the most important thing is probably what we haven't heard or what we haven't seen from President Biden, which is a phone call to President Erdogan. I think it is very telling because for three administrations now, going back to George W. Bush, U.S.-Turkish relations were dominated by the personal relationship of Erdogan to the U.S. president. And particularly under the Trump administration, that's how things got done. Circumventing regular diplomatic channels and policy processes. And so to withhold that call, I think, is a signal from the Biden administration about how it wants to structure U.S. relations. But I think it's also a personal signal to Erdogan. I think there's an understanding that those personal connections are important to his, to his prestige, to his sense of standing on the world stage, on being a great leader that is respected and, you know, considered an equal by a U.S. president, and by denying him that, I think that is yet another subtle but real form of leverage and distance that this administration is building.
And it's an interesting point that you also mentioned about the phone call, of course, because we've reported on this as well, how at least until recently, across the whole new cabinet, there was a slowness to really reach out to Turkey. Hulusi Akar, the Turkish defense minister, was complaining recently that he has been able to congratulate Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, but he has not been able to get a phone call. Of course, Jake Sullivan spoke to Ibrahim Kalin a few weeks ago, and we only ended up seeing a phone call between Secretary of State Blinken and Mevlut Çavuşoğlu, the Turkish foreign minister, after the whole mess that came in responses after the failed hostage rescue mission last week. So this also, I noticed something that Biden seems to have been keeping other leaders also in the Middle East, at least, at a certain distance. It took him a long time to speak to Benjamin Netanyahu. He openly said that he's not going to speak to the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. And of course, I don't think he's spoken either to the leaders of Egypt, the UAE either right now. What do you think this is indicative of a wider approach from the Biden administration towards the Middle East of restructuring the relationship around more the cabinets and the ministries and away from the personal leaders?
I think it's an interesting question. I think it comes down to a number of factors. It might be that, at least in a number of cases, and we actually saw an explicit statement from the administration that they would be changing the nature of U.S. Relations and contacts with Saudi Arabia and sort of cutting out presidential to crown prince contacts and having President Biden just deal with King Salman directly, which on its surface makes sense because, you know, it's head of state to head of state, at least officially. But I think everyone sort of understands what that's about, and that's about concerns of MBS's roles in the killing of Khashoggi and other issues tied to human rights. And I think that's another part of what's going on as the administration looks at its approach to the region. You know, the Middle East is a fairly easy place to apply the lens of values and standing for democracy that President Biden has said is going to inform his foreign policy. You know, it's a lot harder to figure out how to balance values and interests when you're dealing with a power like Russia or China. You know, although, to be fair, we have to note that the administration has reached out and asked for negotiations, at least with the Iranians, and hasn't raised human rights issues in regards to the Iranian regime. So there is a bit of attention there that has to be addressed. But I think the other part of it is that this administration, like the administration that preceded it and the administration that preceded that one, wants to pivot away from the Middle East. It's no longer seen as the locus of strategic interest for the United States. If anything, it's seen as a distraction from the larger issues that the United States has to deal with, whether that's COVID-19 now or China or climate change, or I guess they all start with C's for some reason. But you know, the Middle East is seen as a distraction and a place that is a drain on U.S. resources and attention and ability to get other things done. And so I think if you look at the list of places that President Biden is calling, he's trying to revive partnerships and alliances that he thinks matter, principally in Europe. And he's trying to align himself against broader global challenges that he thinks, you know, the Middle East is not necessarily important to.
And to pivot quickly back to Turkey, you brought up a good point on the whiplash that's likely getting everyone to scratch their heads over a foggy bottom or at the White House and with these Turkish responses. But what does that say to you about the way that Turkey's feeling out the Biden administration? You know, they were very unhappy with those statements over Bagazici. They also took a lot of umbrage towards the initial statement over the failed hostage rescue related to the PKK last weekend. And of course, but then you have Erdogan come around and say in the same week, that statement was a doozy, but then later say our differences are smaller than our, you know, shared interests. Do you get the impression that Turkey's still waiting to see how it can work with the Biden administration as it's shaping up? Or what do you make of the Turkish side of it?
Yeah, I'd also throw in there was the comment or statement of Lucy Achar in an interview that, you know, there might be some concessions that could be made on the S-400 issue, and you know, those sort of got shot down. Yeah. You know, I would put it this way. I don't think any of that is indicative of the possibility of improved U.S.-Turkish relations anytime soon. I think the bigger question is, what do all of these twists and turns reveal about what is happening in Turkey politically and in the mind of Erdogan specifically? I do think it's the case that after finally attaining what Ibrahim Kalin started yearning for and was it 2013, namely precious loneliness, and after a year, 2020, in which Turkey pretty much alienated or invaded or fought a conflict with anybody it could find, you know, perhaps that sense of being adrift at sea is having some repercussions for Turkey strategically, particularly at a time when its economy is starting to really hurt. But whether there's an actual desire to improve relations for the sake of improving relations, or whether we have, you know, Erdogan looking for some ways to release economic and strategic pressure by finding some sort of Western partner. I think it's important to note that sort of this charm offensive, as short-lived as it's been, was not just directed towards the United States. We had offers of improving relations with Israel. We had talks with Greece in January. We had an exchange of letters with Macron after insults were hurled back and forth. You know, we had talks with the Saudis even. It's really been a bit of a diplomatic, well, I wouldn't say diplomatic, but it's been a bit of a blitz, at least, of offers of dangling the idea that maybe things could be better. And maybe that's because, you know, this sort of precious loneliness is really starting to get to Turkey. Or maybe it's more indicative of dynamics happening at home. You know, it's been interesting to see that we've had different ministers sort of saying different things, and then Erdogan weighing in, right? So there was Hulusi Akar with the S-400 offer. There was Soylu with the accusation of masterminding the 2016 coup attempt. You know, there's Çavuşoğlu about the prisoners executed by the PKK. So it seems like maybe there's also some sort of different camps within the regime and power struggles, and Erdogan is really trying to reconcile all of them. There's also definite political turmoil at home, as you mentioned, with the protests at Bozici. So I think the question is, what is Erdogan trying to do? Not internationally, but what is he trying to do in regards to domestic politics through these attempts? And what does this tell us about the situation at home? It used to be that Erdogan, when he was faced with a domestic political crisis, which was, you know, basically like every year for the last 10 years in Turkey, would try to resolve it by creating a security crisis of some kind, either at home or in the near abroad. It's been interesting to me that isn't the approach that he's taken over the last couple of months, and instead he's sort of been using this attempt to reach out to other countries, and you know, perhaps that suggests that he feels more isolated politically, and his power is somewhat more reserved than we think of when we look at him from the outside and think, you know, this is, as Biden said, an autocrat. We think he controls all the levers of power, but maybe his power sharing arrangement with the MHP and the Eurasianists, is proving to be more difficult than he suspected. Maybe he really, feels that Turkey is reeling economically, and he's just looking to get some economic relief either through, you know, some sort of injection of foreign capital like he got from the Qataris several years ago, or by getting the U.S. to back an IMF deal. Or maybe he's just, really worried that he's gone too far with the Russians, and in Libya and Nagorno-Karabakh, and he's looking for a little security guarantee from the West. But I think either way, what we're seeing in terms of the repeated outreach attempts is not really sincere. It's not really an attempt to patch things up. It's because Erdogan needs something based on where he finds himself right now. And I think the thing that U.S. policymakers really need to figure out is, what is it that he's looking for? What is it that he needs? And what does that tell us about where Turkey is, where Erdogan is, and what it might do going forward?
He does seem, as he tries to at least mend some fences or build some at least ostensible, superficial goodwill with the U.S., he seems to be kind of like picking ideas out of his hat about what he can really get here. And one of them that I found interesting was just some of the recent tension flare-ups basically between Turkey and Iran. We saw at least since November, a few arrests go on about Iranian intelligence operatives inside of Turkey, publicizing that they arrested one of the Iranian consulate officials involved with the assassination of an Iranian dissident or at least former official inside of Istanbul. And one analyst I spoke to shortly after those events told me that these events, like these poking Iran in the eye, basically for Erdogan, is a way to signal to the U.S., maybe we can be useful on this front. Maybe we can talk about this. But and then, you know, Erdogan has also stated that he's interested in seeing the nuclear deal be restored or renegotiated. What I want to ask you, Blaise, because I know that you have covered Iran a lot in your work too, is what does that mean for the Turkish-Iranian relationship? Is it just the continuation of that rivalry, or is Iran suddenly just more expendable to Turkey if it means improving relations with, say, Washington?
Yeah. So I came to my interest and watching of Turkey later than most, and certainly, the image that sticks in my mind that made me take notice of Erdogan and start thinking about what was going on in Turkey was it 2009, 2010, when Erdogan stood on a stage with Ahmadinejad and Lula from Brazil. You know, they were all holding hands and announcing that they had negotiated the nuclear deal. They had sort of solved this crisis. And so I think it's sort of worth remembering that when we think about where Erdogan might be on the nuclear deal and the Biden administration's outreach to Iran. I don't buy for a minute that whatever Turkey is doing with Iran and the recent arrest that you mentioned has anything to do with signaling some sort of cooperation that that Turkey might now undertake with the United States on Iran, for several reasons. First of all, if Turkey wanted to cooperate with the United States against Iran, then it had 4 years of a Trump administration that was desperately asking Turkey to do exactly that. I think the best shot that Turkey actually had of repairing ties with the U.S. was during the Trump years, when you had people in the State Department who actually thought that whatever else Erdogan did, like if he would fight Iran for us, like that would forgive all sins, domestic and foreign. We were willing to throw overboard the SDF and YPG if only Turkey would fight Iran for us. So if they're just now coming to the realization, well, maybe we could help fight Iran for the U.S., then you know they're a dollar late, a day late, and a dollar short. Secondly, the Biden administration doesn't want to fight Iran. So rolling up Iranian networks in Turkey or trying to signal that it's tough on Iran is not the way to the Biden administration's heart. And I think the Turks know that, which is why they've been signaling that they're willing to be tough on the country that that Biden wants to be tough on, which is Russia, right? That's been their selling point in the short-lived charm offensives, is we're fighting the Russians in Libya. We fought them in Nagorno-Karabakh. We can fight them together. So I don't think that there's a Turkish offer on the table to the U.S. to fight against the Iranians. I do think that the Turks would welcome the reentry of the United States into the JCPOA. I think that has nothing to do with, you know, a desire to return peace or stability to the region. I do think it has everything to do with, as we were just talking about, the fact that the Turks are basically isolated from everyone else, for better or worse. Despite what is happening in Syria, the closest thing that Turkey has to an alignment in the region is with Iran through sort of the shared Qatari axis. You know, for better or worse, they've agreed to work diplomatically with Assad and Iran and Moscow to you know, resolve the Syria issue, whatever that means. And so I think they're more or less committed to trying to see the Iranians benefit from the JCPOA. You know, they obviously also want to trade with the Iranians. They're willing to do that under sanctions, as we saw in the past. But I think they prefer to do that freely without worrying about U.S. sanctions. Obviously, the pending case against Halkbank continues to be a concern for them, and they probably don't want to have another such interaction with the U.S. criminal justice system. So I think, you know, they prefer to see Iran unfettered and strengthened through a JCPOA, would be my sense.
And this actually segues into a recent podcast that I also had with Caroline Rose. She's at the New Lines Institute, in also in D.C. And we spoke about the recent attack on Erbil in Iraqi Kurdistan on February 15th. And she suggested in a paper she co-wrote with another fellow at the Institute that the attack had a symbolic message to both the U.S. and Turkey to signal Iran's discomfort with Turkish policy, at least inside Iraq, as an extension of their discomfort with Turkish policy inside northeastern Syria. And she also offered that there was potentially limited space for the U.S. and Turkey to work together inside of Iraq, at least when it came to Iran. What do you make of that?
I think I see things a little differently. I think it's certainly true that Iran is wary of a potential Turkish offensive into Sinjar, as Turkey has hinted at, at least occasionally, you know, to try to uproot the PKK there. I think that's, you know, that's sort of a bridge too far for the Iranians, who have clearly worked hard to use the Hashd al-Shaabi, the Shiite militias that they back in Iraq, to extend their influence beyond the traditionally Shiite areas, beyond Baghdad. And we've seen them, you know, taking up positions and playing a big role in providing security in Mosul, extending well into sort of the Sunni areas. And they've clearly had a design on extending their influence into Sinjar as well, which I think has a lot to do with the fact that, you know, there's Iranian positions on the other side of the border in Syria, where they're, and, you know, they're trying to link up lines of communications and logistics supplies through there. So on that narrow issue, I think, yes, the Iranians would not want to see further Turkish military operations into Iraq. At the same time, I think there's actually much more convergence of Turkish and Iranian interests in northern Iraq than we might assume, which goes back to the failed referendum and the, you know, the push to get the Kurds to relinquish control of various parts of northern Iraq, where you had the Iranians pushing from one direction and you had the Turks pushing at from another, and there was concerns that they were going to seize and close Fish Khabur. And I think that was a very much a coordinated Turkish Iranian reaction to the possibility of the emergence of an autonomous Kurdish entity in northern Iraq. Since that time, we've seen the Turks invest heavily in building up their relationship with the KDP, the Barzani party in northern Iraq, not just for the purpose of increasing their operations against the PKK in Iraq, but also using the KDP and the Peshmerga to pressure the YPG in northeastern Syria. And I think what we're seeing is, whether it's coordinated or not, and it's probably not, but we're seeing Turkish pressure from the Turkish border and from the Iraqi border on at the same time as we're seeing Syrian pressure on the YPG to begin relinquishing territory, right? I mean, we saw it with the Ain Issa attack, where the Turks began attacking Ain Issa, and the Syrians demanded that the Kurds relinquish control of it and give it over to them. We've seen multiple standoffs between Syrian forces and YPG forces inside northeast Syria as Assad demands sort of greater access and greater control there. At the same time that we've seen clashes between the Peshmerga on the Iraqi side and PKK fighters in Syria, but that have drawn in YPG forces as well. And so what I think you're seeing is a strangling of northeast Syria that's happening, has been happening from the Turkish side, started happening from the Syrian side, and now is happening by the, both the Turks and the Iranians from the Iraqi side as well. And so again, here, I think that there's actually a certain cohabitation that they're comfortable, that the Turks and the Iranians are comfortable with inside Iraq. There's obviously going to be friction, and the Iranians, probably see the country as much more theirs than the Turks. But insofar as they have a shared interest in not seeing northeast Syria remain in the hands of the YPG, the current arrangement seems to suit them.
Speaking of other countries that Turkey's had these sort of relationships with, whether it's in Syria or just where they have a marriage of convenience, so to speak, in a shared neighborhood. I'd like to ask you about Russia now, too, because when we last spoke in October, the U.S. still had not implemented any of the COTSA sanctions on Turkey. And then 2 months later in December, after Trump lost his reelection bid, he did ultimately go ahead with a set of limited sanctions against Turkey and its defense officials. And Russia was, of course, rhetorically supportive of Turkey amidst that, the reputation of their arms was on the line and the relationship they have with Turkey. But do you think that these sanctions will have any sort of, do you think that they had any sort of desired effect of deterring Turkey away from undermining U.S. sanctions when it comes to, say, Russia in this case? And just one other question to go along with that is, how do you think that this new paradigm really alters, if at all, the relationship between those two?
I'm sorry, between Turkey and Russia?
Turkey and Russia.
Yeah, it's a good question. If you wanted to sort of purely look at the sequence of events, you could say that we put COTSA sanctions in place in December, and come January that the Turks were talking about resetting relations with the U.S. So maybe they were having an effect. I tend to doubt that it's the sanctions that are behind those offers.
I would agree.
I think certainly. I think the Turks certainly took notice of the fact that the sanctions were put in place. I think they were surprised by it. They had come to the conclusion that certainly the Trump administration wouldn't do it. I think also the initial read was that the Trump administration sort of chose the bare minimum. It had sort of 12 sanctions to choose from. It had to do five, at least five. It did the five, and it did sort of seemingly the lowest, impact five. At least from what I'm hearing, the Turks are concerned that the impact of those sanctions is actually going to be greater than originally assumed, and is going to impact their ability to sell weapons abroad and sort of build up their domestic defense industry as they have been doing in recent years. So perhaps with time, the impact and the pain that those sanctions cause will increase. But given everything that we know about President Erdogan, I think he's more likely to take umbrage at and sort of use U.S. sanctions as a tool to whip up further anti-American rhetoric and sort of further make the point that the U.S. is who needs allies such as these or whatever it was that he said recently. Saying that and thinking it through, it's also the only time that we've ever seen President Erdogan really back down was when President Trump imposed sanctions in order to free Pastor Andrew Brunson in 2017. But I think those were directed, those were used as a threat. And it was very clear why they were being made. And it was sort of very much a do this or else scenario. Although CATSA sanctions are tied to the S-400, for some reason the Turks continue to think that they can wheedle their way out of it or that some sort of solution can be found, which suggests to me that for whatever reason, sort of the do this or else we're going to cause pain to you message hasn't been felt, or whatever pain they're expecting to get from sanctions is outweighed by whatever benefit they think they're deriving from keeping the S-400. And I think that's the worrisome thing here is not that they don't seem to be concerned about U.S. sanctions, but that they seem so attached to the S-400. And at this point, it's hard to believe that it's because they still think that the Americans are going to cave or that they still think that they can negotiate some better deal out of this. They really think that they're making some sort of strategic investment, which puts the lie to this proposal that they've been floating, that they're going to be the best U.S. partner in fighting Russia, right? If they're going to do that, then they would have been, more willing to give up the S-400s up front. And so I think it goes to show that they're really in a tricky situation with the Russians where they're able to compete with them in certain places, but for core security issues, they still feel very much dependent on them, which probably has to do with Russia's ever-strengthening position in Syria.
The last thing I'd like to ask you is, we actually touched on it a little bit towards the beginning of the conversation, but this week in Politico, Biden's team had reportedly mentioned that he did not consider the Middle East a priority at all, which you also mentioned towards the beginning of this. And as one aide told Politico, they don't even consider it a top three priority issue in the mind of the administration. And this sounds, of course, a lot like either of his predecessors, whether it was President Obama who wanted to back a bit further away from the Middle East or President Trump who wanted to do the same. But of course, when the U.S. pulled back from the Middle East, that created some room for Turkey to maneuver more and often aggressively, whether it was in the Middle East or the adjoining neighborhoods, Libya, Mediterranean, et cetera. So the last thing I'd like to ask you, Blaise, is there a risk that the Biden team could ultimately just end up making same mistakes of its predecessors? Or do you think that the circumstances now force a different approach from Washington?
What mistakes are you referring to?
Well, I guess it would be that pulling away from the Middle East was one of the reasons why they say Turkey asserted itself more forcefully against U.S. interests in Syria, for one example.
Yeah. So. A couple of things obliquely around that before I maybe try to answer the question directly. The first is, if I were the Turks, and I'm clearly the not, but if I were the Turks and I heard people saying things like, well, Biden hasn't called Erdogan or Biden's not paying attention to Turkey because he doesn't care about the Middle East and he wants to get the U.S. out of the Middle East, I'd be alarmed because I'd be saying, I'm Turkey. I'm not the Middle East. I'm a NATO ally. I'm as much European as I am Middle Eastern. You want to fix relations with Europe. You keep talking about the transatlantic alliance. I'm part of that, not this thing that you're trying to leave behind. So the fact that we now sort of unreflexively think of Turkey as a Middle Eastern country, I think would be alarming. I think should be alarming for the Turks, but I think is really indicative of what has transpired under Erdogan's rule with Turkey. So first that. Second, I would say, not speaking of the broader Middle East, but of Turkey specifically, ignoring a little cold shoulder from the U.S. might not be the worst possible approach here. I think part of the problem in U.S.-Turkish relations is that Turkey believes those relations are too big to fail, that it believes that the United States needs it more than it needs the United States. And the past three administrations have done nothing to disabuse Erdogan of that notion. And whether that is, taking phone calls and listening to Erdogan or, sort of complaining about what Erdogan is doing, as long as U.S. policymakers keep talking about Turkey, they feed into this narrative that Turkey is so important to the United States. And clearly the U.S. should want Turkey to be a strategic ally, and it should want a close relationship with Turkey. But it should also make clear to Turkey it's not the end of the world for us if we don't have that. We have other partners and allies in Europe and the Middle East who don't cause us all this heartburn, who do work with us on our issues. And if Turkey's not interested, let's talk next year and see where we are. I don't think that would be a bad signal for the administration to send. More broadly on the Middle East, I do think there's a danger in seeing the region as, the quagmire that we need to pull ourselves out of so we can deal with other issues, both because the decisions that we make in the name of let's get out of here, I think are bad ones. It's, what we did in 2011 and pulling out of Iraq. And that created the conditions that allowed for the rise of the Islamic State and sort of brought us back in. I think an approach to Iran where we try to re-enter the JCPOA just to sort of, check that box and not have to worry about it is also a wrong approach and is probably going to create conditions for Iran to become newly aggressive in the region and cause more headaches and again contribute to instability that might pull us back in. And more broadly, we want to ignore the region, but everyone else is paying more attention to it. The Russians are embedding themselves ever deeper in Syria, in Libya. They're using Libya to inject themselves further into North Africa and the Middle East. The Chinese are active throughout the region. I think the Chinese-Turkish relationship remains opaque, but something that really needs to be looked at more. The Chinese are active in Israel, which should be a real concern for the United States.
And Iran, too, for that matter.
Iran, too. And at the same time, the region, the Middle East, is not confined to the Middle East anymore. The Middle East is spilling out over its geographic boundaries. Look at what happened in Nagorno-Karabakh. Look at the competition between various Sunni countries that's playing out in the Horn of Africa. I mean, Turkey is increasingly engaged in Africa. So to say that we're going to sort of ignore the Middle East and hope it ignores us is sort of not the way that region works, right? Unfortunately, right? What happens in the Middle East doesn't stay in the Middle East.
Never at all. Well, Blaise, it was great to have you on. I'm always happy to have you here at Turkey Abroad to shed some light on a lot of these topics in this ever tumultuous region and about Turkey in particular. So I look forward to having you back sometime soon.
Thank you so much, Nicholas. I really enjoyed it.
My name is Nicholas Morgan. This is Turkey Abroad.
You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here, for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.